Back in the late 1950s, when television still displayed only in black and white, one of the three television networks, there were only three, one of the three television networks broadcast a show called To Tell the Truth. How many of you remember it? Okay, you've got to be at least as old as I am if you remember it. There was a panel of four minor celebrities, and since I was 5 years old, I could never figure out why they were celebrities. I actually don't think anybody else understood why they were celebrities either. Anyhow, there were four celebrities faced by three challengers, and each round began with the challengers claiming to be the same person. My name is Peter Williams. My name is Peter Williams. My name is Peter Williams. Of course, only one of them was Peter Williams. The other two were imposters. And then the host of the show would introduce the person in question with a description of who he was and what he did. And then it was up to the four celebrity panelists to figure out who was the real Peter Williams and who were the imposters. And they did this by asking questions. Number one, what are the ingredients in Boston cream pie? Number three, what's the name of the minor league baseball team in Omaha, Nebraska? I mean, they could ask anything they wanted. And the true Peter Williams had to tell the truth as best he could. The imposters could lie through their teeth. And at the end of the round, the four celebrity panelists voted for who they thought the real Peter Williams was by holding up a number, and they held it up so that the others couldn't see who they were voting for. And then the moment of truth arrived when the host said, "Will the real Peter Williams please stand up?" And that person would then be revealed. And the imposters won prize money based on the number of votes that they garnered for thinking that they were the real Peter Williams or whoever. Reality TV was actually invented in the 1950s. I mean, who knew? I have entitled my sermon this morning, "Will the Real Apostle Paul Please Stand Up?" Because I believe that if some of us, and we're not even minor celebrities, but if some of us were on a panel faced by the real Apostle Paul plus a couple of imposters, I wonder how many of us would vote correctly. I think many of us have a mistaken picture of the Apostle Paul in our minds. We have a picture of some kind of spiritual Superman. I mean, he may not have quite been the Son of God, but he was the next thing to it. We have a picture of Paul that has no gaps, no weaknesses, no faults or foibles. But I'm here to tell you this morning that the Apostle Paul had problems and discouragements just like the rest of us. He didn't go 16-0 every season. He didn't pitch a shutout in every game. He stubbed his toe and he got tired and he got sick just like every other human being. And perhaps more than anywhere else in the Bible, the very human side of Paul, with his frailties and his weaknesses, is revealed here in Acts chapter 18. So let's read together the first 17 verses, Acts chapter 18, beginning in verse 1. "After these things, Paul departed from Athens and went to Corinth. And he found a certain Jew named Aquila, born in Pontus, who had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had commanded all the Jews to depart from Rome. And he came to them. So because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them and worked, for by occupation they were tent makers. And he reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath and persuaded both Jews and Greeks. When Silas and Timothy had come from Macedonia, Paul was compelled by the Spirit and testified to the Jews that Jesus is the Christ. But when they opposed him and blasphemed, he shook his garments and said to them, "Your blood be upon your own heads. I am clean. From now on I will go to the Gentiles." And he departed from there and entered the house of a certain man named Justus, one who worshipped God, whose house was next door to the synagogue. Then Crispus, the ruler of the synagogue, believed on the Lord with all his household. And many of the Corinthians, hearing, believed and were baptized. Now the Lord spoke to Paul in the night by a vision, "Do not be afraid, but speak, and do not keep silent, for I am with you, and no one will attack you to hurt you, for I have many people in this city." And he continued there a year and 6 months, teaching the word of God among them. When Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, the Jews with one accord rose up against Paul and brought him to the judgment seat, saying, "This fellow persuades men to worship God contrary to the law." And when Paul was about to open his mouth, Gallio said to the Jews, "If it were a matter of wrongdoing or wicked crimes, O Jews, there would be reason why I should bear with you. But if it is a question of words and names and of your own law, look to it yourselves, for I do not want to be a judge of such matters." And he drove them from the judgment seat. Then all the Gentiles, the Greeks, took Sosthenes, the ruler of the synagogue, and beat him before the judgment seat. But Gallio took no notice of these things. When we last left Paul at the beginning of December, he was in Athens. After spending a few days alone in Athens after his presentation on Mars Hill, he traveled alone another 50 miles to the city of Corinth. So Paul ended up in Corinth alone. And Corinth was every bit as intimidating as Athens in its own way. To quote the commentary written by James Montgomery Boyce, three words describe Corinth, and they're easy to remember because they all begin with the letter C, like Corinth. First of all, Corinth was commercial. We could say that Corinth was primarily commercial. Corinth sat at the crossroads, both north and south and east and west, of the little strip of land in the middle of I don't want to make you look at your maps right now, but Greece is kind of like in two big blobs, and there's this little strip of land between those two big blobs, and Corinth sits right there. And so both shipping, east and west, and caravans north and south had to pass through Corinth. In the second place, because of its position there in the nation of Greece, it was also cosmopolitan. Because it was a trade center, there were people and ethnic groups from all over the world at Corinth, including a Jewish population. Corinth would have been much like many major cities in the world today, like New York City, for instance, a melting pot, many different nationalities and religions and ethnicities. And then third, perhaps you know this, Corinth was corrupt. Let me quote Dr. Boyce. "Corinth was a center of the cult of the love goddess Aphrodite. The temple of Aphrodite in Corinth was one of the architectural wonders of the ancient world, and at one time there were 10,000 temple prostitutes. They did business with the sailors and other commercial people who passed through the town. If you were called a Corinthian in the ancient world and were not actually from Corinth, you would regard that name as an insult." Corinth was corrupt. Now, when Paul arrived in Corinth, he was not in a good frame of mind. There is another New Testament passage that we need to read in addition to these verses in Acts chapter 18. So keep your finger here and flip over with me a few pages to 1 Corinthians chapter 2. 1 Corinthians chapter 2. First Corinthians 2 and verse 1. And I, brethren, he's speaking to the Corinthians, and I, brethren, when I came to you, did not come with excellence of speech or of wisdom declaring to you the testimony of God. For I determined not to know anything among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. I was with you in weakness, in fear, and in much trembling. Weakness, fear, and trembling. Now, I need to tell you, I have read those words scores of times in the past. And I have always dismissed them as Paul being a little bit overly dramatic. I mean, like one of us saying, I'm just scared to death about what the next 4 years hold. I mean, we say that kind of thing. And we don't really mean it literally. They're hyperbole when we say things like that. And I've always put these words into that category until this week as I studied and researched Acts chapter 18. And I now believe that these words here in 1 Corinthians 2 tell us exactly what Paul was thinking, exactly what Paul was feeling when he arrived in Corinth after recent traumatic events in his life. I no longer think that Paul was being overly dramatic. I believe he was telling the truth. We are to take his words literally at face value. I was with you in weakness, in fear, and in much trembling. So for the next few minutes this morning, let's try to get behind the eyeballs of the Apostle Paul. Let's try to see things from his perspective. Let's try to get inside of his head and understand what he must have been thinking, what he must have been feeling at this point. What caused the Apostle Paul to be in weakness and in fear when he arrived in Corinth? What discouragements had he recently faced? What impact did recent traumatic events have on him? First of all, Paul suffered extreme persecution. Paul had suffered extreme persecution. Now, I think it's easy for us to see the ministry of the Apostle Paul through rose-colored glasses. We remember that on his first and second missionary journeys, he succeeded in starting a number of local churches. I mean, we see Paul as the greatest model of missionary endeavor for all time. And it's easy to gloss over how much opposition Paul faced. I want you to listen carefully to the next sentence. Nearly everywhere he went, Paul faced mob violence and legal challenges. Now, how would we react if we got a newsletter from the Nunez or an email from the Messers and they told us that a mob had rioted at their church and dragged them, literally dragged them to the local police station and pressed charges against them based on half-truths or outright lies? I mean, we would be calling a prayer meeting. We would be praying for God to protect them. We would be praying for God to deliver them. We would be communicating, maybe you need to come out of that country. You're not safe there. Paul faced this everywhere he went. This wasn't unusual. This was the norm. Let's recap what happened to Paul during his first and second missionary journeys. The opposition began in earnest when Paul left with Barnabas, left Cyprus, and went north into the nation that we now know as Turkey. They called it Asia Minor. In Antioch of Pisidia, the gospel had success. There were people that were saved. But we read in Acts 13 and verse 50, "But the Jews stirred up the devout and prominent women and the chief men of the city, raised up persecution against Paul and Barnabas, and expelled them from their region." The local leaders stirred up mob violence, and the mob ran them out of town. In the next town they went to, in Iconium, the same thing happened. In Acts 14, verses 5 and 6, we read, "And when a violent attempt was made by both the Gentiles and the Jews with their rulers to abuse and stone them, they became aware of it and fled." Paul and Barnabas were one step ahead of being stoned by a mob in Iconium. In Lystra, the next city to which they went, the mob from Antioch and Iconium caught up with them. And here's what we read in Acts 14 in verse 19. "Jews from Antioch and Iconium came there, and having persuaded the multitudes, they stoned Paul and dragged him out of the city, supposing him to be dead." Stoning's intended to kill. And they thought they had succeeded. And I think finally the mob dispersed, and we're told in the next verse that Paul finally regained consciousness. I don't know, maybe God miraculously healed him, or maybe God actually resurrected him. And he stood up and walked away with the brethren. Paul began his second missionary journey by going back through these very same cities and strengthening the churches. Can you imagine going back to the very same places where you were mobbed and nearly killed? And then God directed Paul to Greece. The Macedonian vision, "Come over and help us." And there in Philippi, Paul had success. They planted a new local church. But you remember the story from Acts chapter 16. Paul cast a demon out of a girl. And then Paul and Silas ended up being dragged before the local judges, who didn't even hear their case. They just tore the clothes off of their backs in front of the mob and have them beaten with rods by the police. And then thrown into prison. This was the first time in Paul's life that he'd ever been thrown in jail. Imagine getting a newsletter from one of our missionaries telling how they had been punished by a local judge and thrown in jail. Now here's the thing. Paul was a smart guy. He could see where this was going. He could add two and two and make four. Every time he entered a new town, he followed a standard operating procedure. He would preach in the synagogue, and some Jews and God-fearing Gentiles would be saved, and he would have the nucleus of a new local church. But that procedure also ginned up tremendous opposition from the Jews that did not receive the gospel. They viewed him as a false prophet. They viewed him as a heretic. And this opposition usually took the form of mob violence that nearly ended up taking Paul's life time after time. Now, if you knew that that is what you faced everywhere you went, wouldn't you be afraid? Paul said he arrived in Corinth in fear and trembling, and I believe him. When he could look back on these experiences. And then let's add a second piece to this puzzle of why Paul was discouraged when he arrived at Corinth. Paul viewed his ministry in Athens as a failure. Paul viewed his ministry in Athens as a failure. Now, I'm going to engage in a bit of reading between the lines. As I mentioned to you, when Paul went to towns and cities, he had a standard operating procedure. He first went to the synagogue. After preaching there, at times he would turn and evangelize the Gentiles more directly. Paul always had a team with him to do this ministry. In Athens, he did not follow any of those standard operating procedures. In fact, Paul was in Athens only for a very short time. And for all of these reasons, many New Testament scholars believe that Paul did not intend to plant a church in Athens. And I agree with them. But I believe that Paul was still discouraged by what happened in Athens, because Paul had a tremendous opportunity. He had an opportunity to address the philosophers on Mars Hill. But his presentation of the gospel was cut short. He never got to preach the core of the gospel message, Christ crucified. And that's why I believe Paul said in the passage that we just read a few moments ago, there in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, why he said that he was determined not to know anything among you except Christ crucified. Paul was determined never to let that kind of an opportunity ever slip away from him again. Christ crucified was always going to be front and center in his message. Now, a handful were saved in Athens, and I think Paul rejoiced because of that. But I believe that Paul, at this point, was dissatisfied with himself, with his own performance in Athens. You know how that feels? You know how it is when you believe you failed? When you've blown it? I believe Paul very much was feeling that as he came from Athens to Corinth. And then we can add a third reason for fear and discouragement as Paul arrived in Corinth. Paul ran out of funds for the first time. Paul ran out of money for the first time. Here in Acts 18, we see Paul plying his trade for the first time. Most of us here know that Paul was a tent maker. This story has made famous the idea of missionaries being tent makers today, often in order to get into countries where missionaries are not welcome. But you need to understand a couple of things. First of all, Paul may not have actually made tents. The word that's used here and translated tent makers can more generally mean those who worked with leather. They made tents out of leather back then. And so Paul may have been a leather worker. Some even believe that Paul may have been a weaver of some kind, because the word that's used has to do with the skin of a goat. And it may be that he worked weaving material that was made out of goat's hair. But what's clear from the New Testament is that Paul laid great value on working with his hands, on knowing a trade. And that came from his Jewish roots. Remember, Paul had trained to be a rabbi, but rabbis always learned a trade. They learned a trade so that they did not have to be financially supported by the people that they taught. And that trade stood Paul in good stead here. But the fact that Paul made tents or worked with leather at this point in Corinth really points up a more important truth. Paul had never worked at his trade before this point on any of his missionary journeys. Apparently, his home church in Antioch, the church that had commissioned him and sent him out, they had also provided financially for him. But at this point in his missionary endeavors, Paul ran out of money for the first time. Now again, think about that. How would you feel if you ran out of money in a foreign country? This is a fearful circumstance. And then add a fourth detail. Paul was alone. Paul was alone. I've mentioned this fact before in our discussion this morning, but I want to plow this furrow a little bit deeper. Paul was a team player. He always had a Barnabas or a Silas, and usually he had a Mark or a Timothy as well. But in this case, because of what happened in Philippi, Paul had agreed to leave that area. And he left Silas and he left Timothy behind to continue to do the pick and shovel work of getting the churches in that area established. And so Paul was alone during what I believe was one of the darkest times in his life. And you know how it is when the only person you have to talk to is yourself. And you're going through a really tough time. I mean, self-talk can be really bad. It can be really difficult. I believe that the Apostle Paul was the kind of person that did not do well alone. He was not a loner. And yet, here he was in Corinth alone. And then on top of all of these factors that happened before Paul got to Corinth, we need to note a couple of things that happened after Paul got to Corinth. Paul was rejected in the synagogue. Verses 4 through 6 here in Acts 18 indicate that Paul reasoned each Sabbath in the synagogue. The rest of the week, he was supporting himself by working as a tent maker. He preached in the synagogues only on the Sabbath. But what's different here is we read of no conversions. That's a different outcome than in nearly every other town or city to which Paul went. In fact, these verses seem to indicate that the only results that Paul's preaching had was opposition from the Jews. The kind of opposition that Paul had seen everywhere else. And that opposition had to put fear in Paul's heart. Paul wasn't made of marble. He hadn't been inoculated with some vaccine that made him immune to the fear of being beaten or stoned or killed or imprisoned. Paul had seen how things had played out in half a dozen other towns, and he knew what happened next. It's no wonder he said, "I was with you in weakness, in fear, and in much trembling." Then finally, there's a word in Luke's summary in verse 6 that we need to note. Paul's preaching caused the Jews to blaspheme. Now that wasn't common. Verses 4 through 6 indicate a progression in Paul's preaching. I think because Paul could only preach on the Sabbath, it took him a while to kind of prepare the Jews in the synagogue for what he was going to say. But there came a point to where Paul proclaimed that Jesus is the Messiah. Or maybe we could better put it, the Messiah is Jesus. And what was the response of the Jews? Verse 6 tells us that not only did they reject Paul, not only did they reject the gospel, but they blasphemed. They defamed Jesus. They dishonored Jesus. They reviled him. Remember, Jesus died by capital punishment as the worst kind of criminal. And if Paul was as good as his word, and he preached Christ crucified, then the Jews were able to turn the gospel into a sword to slash Jesus into little pieces with. And that may have been the worst cut of all for Paul. So I hope I've demonstrated to you that Paul was not a man of steel. He was not a Superman. He experienced fear and discouragement just like we do. But now everything that I've said to this point, in some respects, has been my introduction. Because the real subject of Acts chapter 18 is not Paul, it's God. And what God did to encourage Paul in this circumstance. And this is where Acts chapter 18 intersects with 2021. Are you fearful? Discouraged? Troubled? As 2021 begins? I saw a meme this week. It was based on an old Far Side comic, those of you that know Far Side. So the picture, the panel, had a picture of an old lady as only Gary Larson could draw her, jumping out of a building on fire on the left side of the picture and jumping down into, you know, one of those trampoline type things that firemen were holding. And she's bouncing off of the trampoline into another building on the right side of the panel, and the building is on fire. And some smarty pants had labeled the building on the left side 2020 and the building on the right side 2021. And that's pretty much exactly how many of us feel. Out of the fire, into the fire. If that's the way you feel today, in any sense, well, you need to take encouragement from how God responded to Paul when he was low. How God responded to Paul in his weakness and his fear, because this is your God. This is my God. So first of all, looking at how God encouraged Paul, responded to Paul in his weakness and fear, God led Paul to strong Christians with whom to ply his trade. Verse 2 says that Paul found a certain Jew named Aquila and his wife Priscilla. But we must see God's providence here in Paul finding them. They were from Rome. In fact, the evidence, they're mentioned seven times in the New Testament. The evidence is that they were core members of the church in Rome before persecution drove them from that city. They were strong Christians. We find them at the end of this chapter, Acts chapter 18, setting Apollos straight and really launching Apollos on a tremendous apologetic and gospel ministry. Now, I'm sure that Paul looked for someone with whom he could practice his trade in Corinth, but I am just as sure that God led Paul to this Christian couple. Or let me turn it around and put it this way. I am just as sure that God orchestrated the circumstances in Rome that brought Aquila and Priscilla to Corinth at the very time that Paul needed them. Not only did God send Aquila and Priscilla for such a time as this, God also sent Silas and Timothy. Verse 5 says that Silas and Timothy arrived from Macedonia, from Greece. Help arrived. The team was back together. Paul no longer had to shoulder the entire burden alone. Have you ever had that experience? Where you're undertaking some task, some project, and everything was on you? And then help arrives. Fresh meat. Finally, I don't have to do this whole thing myself. And if you've ever had that experience, then you can feel the relief and the release that Paul must have experienced. Silas and Timothy are back. And then God encouraged Paul in another very tangible way. God provided for Paul's financial needs. Now we have to put two and two together here to arrive at this understanding. But verse 5 tells us that Silas and Timothy came from Macedonia. In 2 Corinthians 11 and verse 9, I'm not going to ask you to turn, but you may want to jot it down. In 2 Corinthians 11 and verse 9, we read, this is Paul writing to the Corinthians, "And when I was present with you and in need, I was a burden to no one. For what I lacked, the brethren who came from Macedonia supplied." So Paul says, when I was with you and I was in need, I didn't burden anybody in the Corinthian church. I worked my trade as a tent maker until my brothers came from Macedonia and they brought support from the church in Philippi and the church in Thessalonica and the church probably in Berea. And there are verses in the New Testament elsewhere to show that. That the Philippians supported Paul, that the Thessalonians supported Paul. So at this point, up to this point in Corinth, Paul had worked 6 days a week and he had evangelized only on the Sabbath day. I believe that that changed completely once Silas and Timothy got there. He was back to his 7 days a week evangelism. And as the story continues in verses 7 and 8, we learn that God finally blessed Paul's ministry with numerous converts. Finally, Paul saw fruit in Corinth. Many were saved and baptized, including the leader of the synagogue. Think about that. Now you need to understand, the leader of the synagogue was not a rabbi. That's not talking about the rabbi. There probably was not a rabbi in Corinth. But this would have been one of the leading Jews in that city. And his conversion, his recognition of Jesus as Messiah would have influenced many. And of course, I think for the Apostle Paul, there would have been nothing more encouraging than success in God's work and seeing souls turn to Jesus and seeing the church being established and growing. It would have made it all worth it to him. But in terms of addressing Paul's fear, verses 9 and 10 are key. They are the heart of this passage. God spoke encouragement directly to Paul. Now, I say God, but the Lord here in verse 9 is Jesus. God the Son spoke encouragement to Paul. And there were three emphases, three thrusts in the words that the Lord Jesus spoke to Paul. Number one, Jesus directly addressed Paul's fear. He said, don't be afraid to speak. Don't be afraid to evangelize, to preach, to persuade. And to bolster that command, to not fear. The Lord attached a promise. No one will attack you in this town. Now that those words must have been like a warm blanket on a cold night to the Apostle Paul. Because he was at the very point, remember, a bunch of people had gotten saved now. Things were really moving. He was at the very point where in every other city, what happened? Mob violence, dragging him off to the magistrate. That was the next thing that was on the docket. And so when Jesus said to him, "Don't be afraid. No one is going to attack you in this city." Paul's courage must have gone from that little mustard seed to a great mustard tree. What a tremendous promise from God. In the second place, Jesus also reiterated a promise that God made to his people again and again in Scripture. "I am with you." God made this promise to Jacob, to Moses, to Joshua. God made this promise to the children of Israel in the wilderness. God made this promise repeatedly to the children of Israel in captivity. Jesus made this promise to the apostles before he ascended, "For lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the age." And Jesus repeated this promise to Paul in Corinth. In circumstances of fear and discouragement, what does it mean to hear Jesus say, "I am with you"? We're going to discuss that question in the second service. I hope you'll stay. I think it'll be a continued encouragement as we talk about what it means when God makes this promise to us. "I am with you." And then the Lord Jesus said some very different words to Paul. "I have many people in this city." That's a really odd way to put it. Now, I think it's obvious that Jesus did not mean that there were many people in the city that were already saved and Paul just didn't know about it. I don't think that's what he meant. Rather, I believe that the Lord here was speaking with divine foreknowledge that many people would be saved through Paul's ministry. Again, can you imagine how that encouraged his heart? It's like saying, "Sick 'em to a bulldog." There are many people in this city, and they're going to be saved as you proclaim the gospel. Paul stayed there for 18 months, reaping the harvest that God, that the Lord Jesus had promised him here in this vision. And then this chapter records a final incident which ultimately delivered Paul from fear and trembling. God delivered Paul from a mob by means of a callous magistrate, by means of a callous civil leader. Despite the promises that Jesus Christ made to Paul, things eventually did indeed go exactly as they had in numerous other towns and villages. According to verse 12, the Jews again resorted to mob violence. They dragged Paul to the local courthouse to face charges, and they were serious charges. Corinth was the capital of Achaia. It was the capital of that region of Greece. Gallio was a Roman proconsul. And according to Roman law, Judaism was a legal religion. But these Jews came to Gallio and said, "What this guy is trying to do is to set up an illegal religion. Not according to law, they said. That's the idea. And if Paul had been convicted of this charge, he could have lost his life. But Gallio made a wise decision. In fact, I believe that it may be the first decision in recorded history that reflects our modern notion of the separation of church and state. Gallio didn't even let Paul make any defense. He dismissed the entire case because it was not his function as the civil magistrate to decide religious matters. Gallio was centuries, many centuries ahead of his time. But here's the thing. I don't think Gallio made that decision because he was a wise ruler. I believe Gallio made that decision because he didn't care. He was completely apathetic. And that apathy is demonstrated by what happened in verse 17. Now, I have wondered for many, many years what the Gentiles beating Sosthenes, the new leader of the local synagogue, had to do with this case that was brought against Paul. I mean, this was, you know, one of those things I was going to ask somebody about when I got to heaven. What was that all about? And finally this week, as I researched this, I think I finally figured out what was going on here. So you have to remember, these Jews brought Paul to the, not really the Supreme Court. I guess this would be like the state Supreme Court. So they brought Paul to the state Supreme Court, to what was called the Bema seat. This was a really big deal. This wasn't just the Jews there that day. Everybody would have been there that day. A lot of Gentiles around. And when Gallio said, I don't want to have anything to do with this case, Jews, and he drove the Jews away from the Bema seat, it was then that the Gentiles decided it was a really good time to engage in a little bit of anti-Semitic payback. You think anti-Semitism is modern? Anti-Semitism is not modern. And so you have the Gentiles here say, now is going to be a great time to take it out on the Jews. And so they grab a Jewish leader, Sosthenes, who's the new leader of the synagogue, and they beat him. I don't know if they beat him with rods. I don't know if they whipped him. I don't know if they beat him with their fists. But they beat him before Gallio in his full view there before the Bema seat. And Gallio basically said, I don't care. But here's the thing. The name Sosthenes appears one other time in the New Testament. In the first verse of 1 Corinthians, Sosthenes was apparently the person who actually wrote the book of 1 Corinthians while Paul dictated it. I don't know exactly what happened. Someday I'll know. But I believe that what happened that day drove Sosthenes to Jesus Christ. I have to wonder if the Apostle Paul did not reach out to him. And he became a disciple of Jesus and a helper of the Apostle Paul. What a wonderful story. But the upshot of it all is that Gallio's decision gave the Apostle Paul cover for the next 18 months to freely proclaim the gospel and to establish a church there in Corinth. Now, we would be in error if we took this story here in Acts 18 to mean that God will intervene in our lives in 2021 in exactly the same way He did in the life of Paul when he was in Corinth. But what I want you to see is that God has indeed given us, promised us, several of these mercies. First of all, we don't ever need to be alone. We have team members. We have people that could come alongside of us and help us and support us. That's why God gave us the church. Being part of a local church and a local church that actually gathers is a really big deal in 2020 and 2021. This is part of what God has given us to take us through this difficult time. And if we're not taking advantage of that fellowship, if we're not taking advantage of that support, we are very, very unwise. Number two, God has said to us, I am with you. In Hebrews 13, verses 5 and 6, we read, For he himself has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. I am with you. So we may boldly say, The Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me? That sounds an awful lot like what Jesus said to the Apostle Paul, isn't it? And Jesus says that to all of us. I don't know what may be discouraging you. I don't know what may be making you fearful today. But the same God that met Paul in the middle of the worst circumstances in his life, the darkest days of his ministry, makes the same promises to you and to me. And now, Jesus, I'm sorry to say, has not promised us that he has many in this city. I don't believe we can claim that promise. But here's what he has promised. He's promised, I will build my church. And I will not let the gates of hell prevail against it. He has promised to redeem men from every tribe and tongue and nation. And we can be a part of that. We have the responsibility to be a part of that. And to know that the Lord Jesus will bless that kind of endeavor. So as I close, I really have a very easy challenge to meet today. If you're discouraged, if you're afraid, if you're troubled in any way, you have great and precious promises that you can claim this morning. As we close, it's going to take about 60 seconds of silent prayer. This is our God. As we worship this morning, our God is faithful. Our God is merciful. Our God ministers to us. He meets us in our needs. He says, I am with you. Would you respond to that God this morning? I don't know where you are. I don't know what's happening in your heart, but I know that God will meet you in your need.